like to open the Senate Committee on Education and General Government. And committee, I'd like to open up a public hearing and work session for Senate Bill 484. You might remember this bill from that fateful day, February 11th, almost 2 months ago. On year-round education, we met in the joint session, and it has taken a while to wind its way through the process on an amendment and then getting the appropriate fiscal and revenue statements. Dana, would you like to go through the amendment quickly?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The Dash 1s replace the measure but for the emergency clause. And in the Dash 1 amendments, the Department of Education would be directed to establish a pilot program that would encourage school districts to provide supplemental summer instruction to improve student achievement. The department would be permitted to encourage students to provide the supplemental instruction and establish a process for districts to notify the department of their willingness to participate in the pilot. It would permit the school district to seek funds to offer the supplemental instruction and require a report from the department back to the legislature no later than October 1st, 2010. And the bill itself would sunset January 2nd, 2012. The measure does currently have a referral to Ways and Means, although you do have a minimal fiscal impact statement before you.
So we would rescind that motion. So, colleagues, you know that the goal here is mostly to raise awareness, to lay groundwork. I'm reluctant even to use the word foundation. This is more of digging out the ditch to some way down the road, if we can afford it, to move to year-round education. And I don't mean the staggered schedule modified track, but actual adding days from 170 to 210 or whatever that would look like, and possibly even starting with as few as 10 or 20 days in the summertime. And I think the amendment in language does that. Comments?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 3-2009 to Senate Bill 484.
Senator Morse moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 3-2009. Discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your work on this. And it will be interesting to see what comes back from the report. I've served on an education foundation for many years that helped fund summer programs and after-school programs, and so I'm well aware of the benefits of having students engaged during those periods of time. And just a comment that it's quality as well as quantity, Mr. Chair. So
true.
We'll keep an eye on that as well. So thank you for your work on this.
Further discussion? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 484 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means, the Committee on Ways and Means, be rescinded.
Senator Morris moves that Senate Bill 484 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. The motion passes, and the bill, as amended, is recommended for referral to the Senate President's desk for consideration of the removal of the referral on the Committee on Ways and Means. All right.
Mr. Chair, in the event that that recommendation is taken, would you like to assign a carrier?
I will carry that bill. Thank you. Okay. I would now like to open up a public hearing and a possible work session on SJR 30.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SJR 30 expresses support for the Oregon Progress Board in developing Oregon Shines 3.
We have some testimony here from Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, Frank Morris, representing Senate District 8, areas of Albany, Albany-Corvallis, Lynn, Benton counties. Thank you very much for hearing this bill today. The purpose of this bill is to establish a linkage between the good work of the Progress Board and the Legislative Assembly, who has the ultimate responsibility for setting the policy of this state. And we're at a pivotal point in the work of the Progress Board right now, looking at the next phase and how it then links back to the legislature and the work that we do. And it's important that we as legislators, I think, support this effort and have a better understanding of it. This resolution gives us an opportunity to think consciously about how it plays into the broader picture of our state and the policies we create. So, Mr. Chair, colleagues, with that, I would like to turn over to Rita Conrad to share with you more specifically the direction that the board is taking. I do need to advise you that I serve on the Progress Board, so I don't have a totally objective view of the world, I guess, but this is good work, and would hope that we can recognize that within the body and support it.
Senator Morris, and we do know that you're on that board, and I think it's terrific for Oregon to have somebody of your caliber serving on that board. Ms. Conrad?
Thank you, Senator Morris, Chair Haas, and members of this committee. My name is Rita Conrad. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Progress Board, and I'm here to testify, of course, on Senate Joint Resolution 30, which engages the legislature in Oregon Shines 3 in engagement and support. So briefly, I'll give you a little background. Oregon Shines 3 is our state's high-level long-term strategic plan. It was first established in 1989 and updated again in 1997 to Oregon Shines 2. And the plan has always focused on a kind of a triple bottom line of improving and advancing Oregon's economic, social, and environmental well-being sustainably and simultaneously. The Oregon benchmarks are measures that grew out of that process to track how Oregon is making progress towards those three goals. In the case of Oregon Shines 2, those three goals are quality jobs for all Oregonians, engaged, caring, and safe communities, and healthy, sustainable surroundings. So we have 91 benchmarks that point to, in various ways, to how Oregon is doing. And every 2 years, the Progress Board issues a summary report, and we also have 24/7 online benchmark data available to anybody that wants to access it at both at the state level, the county level, and now state agencies are linking their key performance measures to the benchmarks. So we've learned a lot over the past 20 years from the benchmark data. The good news is that the benchmarks provide us a lens on Oregon's progress over time in education, economy, civic engagement, social support, public safety, and the environment. The bad news is that we aren't where we said we wanted to be 20 years ago in Oregon Shines 1. We've made some progress, but the last report, for example, pointed out that Oregon's per capita personal income continues to decline in relationship to the national average. We are once again one of the most hungry states in the nation. That ranking came out in a national source in last fall. And nearly a third of our eighth graders, for example, cannot read at grade level, and it's even worse for students of color. So we have learned over a couple of years, the board has talked to many experts and have concluded that our systems and structures are not designed to achieve the results that we want. And this occurs despite the many well-meaning and hard-working people in the system and the many cross-agency private-public partnerships that we have. One cannot separate, for example, a struggling timber industry from a laid-off logger's need for food, shelter, housing, and a good job. Everything is connected. Time and again, the policy experts that have consulted with the Progress Board have affirmed independently that systemic institutional fragmentation puts a brake on Oregon's benchmark progress. The reason that we need Oregon Shines is that we need a statewide, evidence-based process to begin to overcome these weaknesses in our fragmented systems and structures. The Oregon Shines 3 process will provide a data-driven dialogue, collaboration, and tools for accountability to help us begin that process of thinking and working differently together for a better future for Oregon. The intent of Senate Joint Resolution 30 is to encourage both legislative engagement and support of this process. And this is important because legislative engagement, legislators will find it easier to own and value Oregon Shines 3 and the benchmarks as part of their work as practical tools for strategic policymaking. And lacking that, the board feels that the effectiveness of this work will be greatly diminished. And with your support, we feel it will be easier for numerous stakeholders with diverse perspectives to grasp the urgency of changing the way we think and work together toward a better future for Oregon. Chair Haas and members of the committee, that's my testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. I know that you characterized it as bad news that we're not where we said we wanted to be, but I think that also, though, points to the value of this is we know that, mm-hmm. and it gives us a better, we're in a better position to respond. Questions of Senator Morris and Ms. Conrad? Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Do we have anyone else who wanted to testify on this?
Oh, I'm sorry. I would like to acknowledge we have a board member in the room, aside from Senator Morris, Joe Johnson in the back, and he's accompanied as well.
Okay. Mr. Johnson, thank you. Okay, well, we have no more testimony on it, Senator Morris, and I think we're predisposed to move forward.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move SJR 30 to the floor with a recommendation that it be adopted.
Senator Morris moves SJR 30 to the floor with a recommendation that it be adopted. Discussion? Seeing none. Any objections? Seeing none. The motion passes and SJR 30 is adopted. Senator Morris, would you like to carry this?
I would. Thank you very much.
Okay. And at this time, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 738.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 738 it requires each school district to provide students in grades 9 through 12 with accelerated college credit programs and ensure that such students have online access to accelerated college credit programs. It requires the State Board of Education in consultation with the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to adopt standards for training teachers to provide such instruction. It requires the Department of Education seek federal funds for training teachers and assisting students in paying for tests and fees related to accelerated college credit programs. And it specifies that beginning with the 2015-2016 school year, offerings in accelerated college credit programs will include English, mathematics, and science. The Dash 1 amendments specify that those offerings, including English, mathematics, and science, will begin in the 2012-2013 school year. And that would take effect, the act would take effect as of July 1st, 2012. There's not a fiscal statement on this measure before you.
Take a look at that sterling list of sponsors.
Really? I'm sure that's coincidental.
All right. Who do we have here?
Might be weird.
I think Jennifer Lewis from my staff might want to kick that off, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is she here, Jen?
Yes.
There she is. Okay. And Lee Fales, College Board, do you want to...
I'd say, Ms. Chair, that Senator Metzger knows how to get co-sponsors for a bill to drive to a purpose.
In a little correction there, Senator Cruz, it's having smart staff who know how to get co-sponsors. I cannot take credit for that.
That's true. You did not ask.
That's true.
Yourself.
I did not.
It's a great opportunity to get to know all of you.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, Chair Haas and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Lewis, legislative aide to Senator Metzger. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 738. I'm going to walk you through some elements of the bill, and I also have Lee Fales here with me from the College Board who will give you some real statistics about AP policy. Senate Bill 738 stems from an effort to ensure equity, equality, and educational excellence in all of our public high schools. The bill ensures that every student, no matter their financial status or the district that they reside in has access to rigorous education. Accelerated college programs have countless benefits for students and their schools. Giving students the opportunity to perform at their highest potential has benefits far beyond simple academia, though the College Board will share information on how AP courses can help close the current achievement gap. Upon completion of accelerated college programs, students are more competitive in the college application process. Students are more competitive in college itself in their courses. Scholarships are specifically available for students who successfully complete AP or IB courses. And even more, ensuring that all students are challenged in high school helps to keep students in the educational system who might otherwise leave the system due to boredom. Current federal programs are aimed at providing accelerated college program funding to lower-income districts. However, there are many, too many districts across the state that are considered middle-income. They're too rich to receive federal funding, but too poor to develop the programs on their own, creating a three-tiered system. I do want to note that though the original intent of the bill was to apply specifically to AP courses, we recognize the AP curriculum may not be the best model for all school districts, many of whom utilize programs like IB. With this in mind, the bill identifies accelerated college credit programs as 2+2 programs, advanced placement programs, and IB. While we are focused on AP today, I do think it's important for districts to be able to choose among those options for the program which best fits their student population. The bill also gives option for school districts to offer the courses through online programs. The online component, we felt, is an important opportunity for many rural or small schools who may not have enough students to fill an entire AP course. There's a component of professional development, which is also very essential. And funding. I knew that everything comes down to funding. Senate Bill 738 directs the Department of Education to seek federal and private funds for professional development and test-taking fees. Though the department already receives money from the federal government, we want to ensure that the department is seeking any additional private funds that might be available. I know that there are concerns that this bill creates an unfunded mandate. The implementation of this bill is spread out until 2015 to 2016 in the original drafting and 2012-2013 in the Dash 1 amendment. This gives all school districts adequate time to phase in their new curriculum opportunities into the existing courses. Districts do not have to hire new staff, nor do they need to suddenly create all new curriculum. The curriculum already exists and is ready to be used. Districts need to simply make sure that these courses are available to their students, perhaps even integrate the accelerated college course elements into existing courses. The state establishes requirements and standards in education policy all the time. This is one more policy that ensures our public education system is meeting the needs of all of our students. Senate Bill 738 declares that every student deserves an education that is rigorous and meets their individual needs. Oregon students deserve Senate Bill 738. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions. And Lee can present some great College Board material.
Thank you. We'll let Lee go first and talk later.
Well, thank you. I'm Lee Fales from the College Board, Vice President for their major programs and services. If I can get you to look at the green sheet that has the fifth annual AP reports in the nation and identifies specifically the state of Oregon. For the last 5 years, the College Board has been engaged in making a national report on how students perform across the nation in AP examinations. The AP examination is close to a national examination, and it also represents 32 foreign countries. So those 2 weeks in May, the students sit down, and whether they're in Oregon or China or Singapore, and they're taking the same examination for the competition to show their performance on that. If you would turn to page 3 and 4, I would like to do a little bragging for you in relationship to the students from the state of Oregon. If you look up and on page 3, that you will see that it represents there in the top that 21.2% of the students have participated this past year. That increase in the state represents a fifth overall in the nation and the number of students that are participating in an AP exam. On page 4, it has 13.1, and those are the students that are receiving a 3 or better. And generally a 3 and above on a scale of 1 to 5 indicates college credit. And for each year, you've shown an increase. And normally when we have such a large increase in the number of students participating in a national exam, the scores go up instead of down. And so you have reversed that trend by increasing the number of students, but also maintaining the quality of the performances. So we're very pleased in that regards to demonstrate that component and others in the state. If I can have you also now turn to the last page, page 12. And you see that this is the first time that we've identified students that indicate on the information they have that they're low-income students. And looking at a five-year trend on that point, that there's been an increase in almost doubling of those students. And we expect even more. And we want to tie that in as a way of assisting those students in providing more information to them. And how do we want to do that? If I can get you to flip one more page. You're going to see a heading that says AP Possibilities. For students that are engaged in the PSAT, and that is a standardized national test that's used in the state, we can identify students that have the potential to do well in an AP examination. And I pulled only for your records here students that would do well in AP Calculus. And why calculus? Because if we're talking about maintaining our competitive edge as a country, you start with engineering and calculus and the math components, and students have to demonstrate their ability. You have in the state, and I'll walk you through this so to make sure that you see the numbers because they are extraordinary. If you see the first number, the 20,904, that is the number of students last year that participated in the PSAT on the math section. So that was the first identification of the students. The 7,376 represent the number of students that we predict that would be able to score a 3 or better in AP Calculus. On the right-hand side, you see the number 1,380. That's the number of students that actually participated. Now, again, let me go back. 7,376 are the number of students that have the potential to do 3 or better. You, in that identification of the students, only had 1,380 and represents a score of 892 that got a 3 or better. So you have tremendous potential of students that it can do well in a course that has academic rigor, not only with the academic rigor that's available, but can succeed in doing college-level work. Because of our commitment as an organization, we feel it's more important than to give you just individual numbers. We provide for every high school in the nation the individual name of the student, so that every high school can go through and say, who are those students that are represented in my class that can do well on the 28 subjects that are offered? When we administer the tests, we provide that. We give them a website. They can go to the website, pull down the individual student's name, send a letter to that student, and especially to the parents, and say, your son or daughter has the ability to do college-level work. Are they signed up for those classes? Are the individual school or school district offering the opportunities to have you be engaged in the kind of rigor that can be successful and open those opportunities? And again, I emphasize that we do this at no cost to the school district so that they can have this information. That's a commitment on our part to move forward. If you flip one more time, testing your dexterity here, you'll see that there's a map of the state of Oregon. And the map represents the penetration of where those students are located related to the offerings of the advanced placement program in the state. So you can see by the color coding there, if it's red, the level of participation all the way up to green and beyond. And so you can see the individual districts and the areas in the state where that represents. I would hope that the next time that I have an opportunity to speak to you, that I would see nothing but green across the state, because it's an opportunity for every student that wants to move forward should have and be able to participate in an AP program or a program that offers college rigor so that they can make the right choices and then move forward. The other information that I offered, it's the kind of reading that if you can't sleep at night, it's guaranteed to put you to sleep. So it identifies the 10 Education Commission of the State's recommendations of what is needed for a strong, advanced program in higher learning. And you have identifications of those 10. It's not fully implemented, but you can do that and reassure for the students. The last component, I've been fortunate enough over the last couple of years to work with the state of Florida. And that state has made a determination to expand its AP program offering. Since 2001, they have provided for every student in the state to take an AP examination as many as they want. And they now average 3.5% of their students, 3.5 examinations per students in the state. And what does those numbers mean? To give you an example of what it means is that in the state of Florida, for African-American males, a group that has really just disappeared from the math scene, they have more African-American males taking an AP calculus examination and scoring 3 above than all of the states west of the Mississippi. For Hispanic students and taking AP examinations, they perform higher on an average basis than all of the public schools in the United States in taking an AP examination. They have some incentive programs that they've tied to this to encourage students on that part and also for teachers. But I say that only because that you can know and get a sensitive feeling that it can be done. You have the core basis here that provides the information very directly to the individual school districts, parents, and students for them to make a decision about a quality education and their performance. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Well, thank you for your presentation. It was excellent. Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Any questions of our panel?
I have just one, just basically a comment. I want to thank Jen Lewis for her really hard work on this issue and kind of bringing this to the forefront of how we extend education. And again, you see the map that was presented to us here in this booklet. It's kind of like deja vu all over again when we were talking about a number of issues where you look at the red and where the red is, same thing where college students are, where we don't have access, and how do we bring everybody into the loop? So, it's a kind of a familiar pattern, but I just wanted to give kudos to Ms. Lewis for bringing this forward.
And ditto for me. I was curious as to what inspired you to come forward with this.
My high school, there weren't AP courses offered for me, and it made the college application process very difficult, even though I was had an almost 4.0 and very involved in school. When you're trying to compete in Ivy League schools, if you don't have the AP IB courses, you're not competitive.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to also thank Jennifer for bringing this to my attention. And I feel a little bit schizophrenic here because as a co-sponsor of the bill, and then with my parent hat on, I have very different views. And so I just want to make a couple comments for the record. I live in a school district, in the Beaverton School District, where every student is given the ACT, and that helps to identify. And I know that's a competitor of College Board, but it helps to identify students who do have potential. But I also want to comment that based on my experience as a public school parent for 15 years, and my children have had both IB and AP classes, that IB and AP classes in no way are always more challenging than classes that aren't IB or AP classes. It completely depends on the teacher and how the curriculum is taught and the dedication and the teacher and how the teacher teaches. In fact, one of my son's most challenging classes was taught by a teacher who wouldn't teach IB or AP classes because he felt that they were too restrictive. in the curriculum because they're sort of a set curriculum. And the other part of me believes that we need to move more away from teaching to tests, and we've heard that certainly with our elementary students going through benchmark testing year after year, and how teachers with No Child Left Behind are teaching to the test, and in some ways AP classes do that. And in fact, my daughter, who's a senior, was offered a choice this year currently to either take the AP test in one of the classes, AP classes that she's taken, or to do an in-depth research paper. And she chose the in-depth research paper because she thought academically she would get more out of that than taking the AP test. And so I see a lot of advantages to this bill, and to especially rural areas and to students who don't have the opportunities. But at the same time, I don't want us to believe that this is going to solve everything on many different levels. And I have attended some seminars on college admissions process, and particularly relating to the commercialization of college admissions process, and heard an interesting story about a student not here in Oregon but in another state who really wanted to take a Shakespeare class, but he wasn't allowed to because his school made him take a pre-PSAT, a prep class for the PSAT. Mm-hmm. And so when we start hearing stories about that students are required to take these test-taking classes instead of taking subjects that would otherwise be more academic, that causes me concern. I'm also concerned about incentive programs, depending on how they're structured, to get students to take more of these tests. I know that they tend to bump up the rankings because that's how high school rankings are done, based on how many students are taking AP tests, and so it concerns me. I want to make sure that those are done. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be incentive programs, but I want to make sure that they're done for reasons of enhancing student achievement rather than bumping up rankings of schools. So thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think we need to have a discussion about this. I see a lot of benefit, but I want us to also be aware that it's not a solution that's going to solve all the problems, and we still need to be aware of making sure that the teachers do challenge, even if that means sometimes going outside of what's considered to be a set curriculum. So thank you. I don't know if you want to respond to that.
I do want to respond to a couple of things that you stated, and one of those that I would be very emphatic about is that AP is an outstanding program, but it should never be the only choice for students. Because what you want to do is provide them the best options to demonstrate their ability, whether it's through IB, dual enrollment, or et cetera. And we're strong advocates of that at the College Board. The second component, as it relates to teacher structure and performance, that the College Board is very concerned to make sure that the materials and the information that we're measuring meets what we state that the AP examination is. It's a demonstration of the knowledge and ability of a freshman year college course offering. To do that, we take one-third of the examinations every year, and a student in at least a minimum of 20 different types of institutions take the AP examination as their end-of-course examination to validate that examination. So when an individual says they're structured and restricted from teaching in a way that they want, the pedagogy is up to that individual. But it must measure the course competencies because it's a freshman class in a freshman year that they would be making. The second part of that I think is important, and this is for parents, is that we require every AP teacher to submit a syllabus so that their parents and students can review that and understand the depth and content knowledge and respond to that. We produce that, and we provide it to every institution, higher ed institution, so that they can look as they measure the students coming in, have they had, quote-unquote, an AP course, so that to make sure that they are getting the quality and the response that they have. The last part, and I think is most important on this, and yet you addressed it, and that's teacher professional development. No teacher in any content area without reinforcement cannot be successful in communicating that information. And that's why the College Board provides, again, an opportunity. We have a website for any teacher to come on, and they can do on a national basis, gather all of the information that's taught by any AP teacher. And we also then make a commitment for having what we call master teachers, so that the teacher can go online with that teacher and say, this is my first year or second year teaching an AP course, and I'm doing cell development. How would I address that? And we provide all of that information and materials to them at no cost, because, again, we're committed to the development for not only for the student, but the teacher, and the best performance on that, and that's the capture of the knowledge.
Thank you.
And if I may, Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, I think at minimum what the bill does is it sets a standard. So it may not be the same that every AP course is the best course in the high school, but at least sets a standard and ensures that every school across the state has that same level of rigor that's offered to the students. And I think that's what we're looking for.
Okay. Thank you both. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Senator Morse. Senator Morse, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for bringing this bill forward. I just had a strong conviction that the statement that we are required to have a uniform system of public instruction means more than just publicly funded. And essentially, that's all it's been. And for example, probably the smallest school district, if not the smallest, it'd have to be Jordan Valley School District. How do those students have the same opportunities that Senator Bonamici's children have? And that's what we need to be focusing on, is how do we achieve that? The only possible way is to embrace technology. And so I really appreciate bringing this forward. I think it's an excellent piece of legislation. My question is, are we prepared for it? Do we have the resources to support these small districts so that they can have these opportunities? And I hopefully that we can, but I don't know where that lies.
I don't want to prolong the conversation, but I do want to reassure you that that's also a response in a very important area that we're looking into, and we've begun to address it in several different ways. One is distance learning. For the 28 courses that we have available, and if the state is willing, we do what we call course development so that they can develop the courses with us to apply those online. Not only do we want to apply the courses online, but you will see that we want to develop a tutorial so that the students can go at their own leisure and at their own pace and be able to gather information from not the classroom, but for the tutorial parts of earning the information. We also provide them with free access that where they can be online in contact with other students that are taking the courses and share information on that part, because we think it's critical for helping students that they feel the isolation and say, I'm the only one taking this very difficult course, and get reinforcement from other students. Every test that we administer, we provide back to the students absolutely free, so they can see the previous year test examination. So when they're looking at the essay component, they can say, what was a 5 in the U.S. history? So they can see an example of a 5, a 4, a 3, a 2, or 1. So again, our effort is to make sure that those students have resources that haven't been available, and continue to reinforce that. And we put that on the web, and we're working on a password component, what we call a portfolio for students, so that as they begin the process, not only will they have access to this information, but it will tell them of important dates and information that they need to be aware of. And somebody mentioned, I think, ACT, which I'll refer to as Brand X. But we even include their dates of administration so that students will know, and parents. We provide information for students and parents on every scholarship in the United States so they can have access to that information. We provide information for parents so they can go through and take their financial information and say, if I was looking at X institution, what would it cost me? and what are the sources of financial assistance I can receive. So those are the things, as you look through this, you'll find that it's a commitment from our organization that we want to give back and to assist parents and students to help them make good educational choices.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It dawned on me, for International Baccalaureate classes, there's some sort of certification process that the schools go through from the International Baccalaureate program. Is there a comparable analysis for AP classes?
There is. We have summer institutes, and the summer institute lasts from 3 to 4 days, in which teachers go through an intensified staff development process, and we provide them information after they're completed in the subject area. But that endorsement by the College Board does not prevent them from teaching an AP course. I want to be clear. That's the principal's decision or the district decision who teaches their courses.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Don Lee and Leah Mullen.
Good afternoon, Chairman Haas and committee. I'm Don Lee, Senior Director of Government Affairs for K-12 Incorporated. We're a provider of online curriculum and school services. And I have with me Leah Mellon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Leah Mellon, and for the record, I'm here on behalf of Kaplan Virtual Education.
We're here in support of Senate Bill 738, and you know the discussion has been very thorough, comprehensive, and very very exciting to listen to as someone who's experienced and watched this the whole concept of access of students to higher quality courses and education throughout the country. Some examples is the state of Michigan a few years ago passed legislation that required as a condition of graduation that all students must have some online experience in order to graduate from high school. Another example of the movement toward AP and college credit courses in high school is the Running Start program in Washington State, or Early Colleges Charter School in Colorado, where a student can actually graduate with an associate's degree from high school. By partnering with local community colleges, this is just, you know, the mind is basically just the can take you to all types of ways of improving the as Senator Morse mentioned, the uniform and general system of common schools in Oregon. And what this bill will do is raise the level of quality of the common schools within the state and provide access to all students. The type of courses that shouldn't matter where the child's zip code is, but what the access can be provide for these kids. So we're very much in favor of this bill, and would be here for its implementation to help through the process.
And just to reiterate what Jen Lewis said, the curriculum is already available. K-12, Kaplan, and other various vendors are already providing AP courses to the charter schools that they're servicing throughout the state. And growing up in Coquille, Oregon, I was one of those kids that also, in high school, I didn't have access to AP courses, and it did affect college applications. And it's a good opportunity to provide rural school districts with AP courses so that the students do have the same access that they have in the bigger districts.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 738? I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 738. And I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 906.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 906 would create a task force on increasing the numbers of Oregon students in post-secondary education. It would have 15 folks on the task force. And the task force would be charged with investigating expansion of best practices such as Gear Up and Aspire and determining the earliest appropriate age to introduce students and families to the idea of post-secondary education. A report would be required to be submitted to legislature no later September 1st, 2010. The Department of Education would staff the task force, and it would sunset upon the convening of the next regular biennial legislative session. You do have a fiscal and revenue impact statement on this measure.
Senator Metzger, did you want to?
Yes, Stacy Michelson, I think we'll kick this one off. The second one of the duels.
Yes. Did you want to make any comments?
No, I think I'll let Ms. Michelson do
that. Okay, Stacy.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Stacy Michelson, legislative aide to Senator Metzger, and I am here today to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 906. First of all, I'd like to thank you for giving this bill a public hearing. You asked Jen when she was done what her impetus was in her bill, and so I'm going to start off telling you what my reason was for my bill, because personally I find that most convincing of all. So I'll start with a little story of how, at the beginning of this session, I sat in the Joint Education Committee and listened to everyone talking about the 40-40-20 goal. And we all sat around and scratched our heads and said, how do we get Oregon students into post-secondary education programs? What do we do? And I was sitting there thinking about this and reflecting on this and thinking, well, why did I go to college? Why was I interested in a post-secondary degree? And it occurred to me that I had never not thought about going to college. It never occurred to me that college would not be an option. And I graduated from where I'm at, and at 14, I was sitting at my computer looking at college programs online, trying to decide where I wanted to go, where I wanted to be applying in 3 years. And I know that's a little bit unique. Most students aren't quite as nerdy as I was. But I graduated with many classmates from a small high school in rural southern Oregon with students who had never thought about going to college. They assumed that they would not go to college. So when our junior and senior years rolled around, we had guidance counselors trying to convince everyone to apply to college programs. It was pretty hard to convince some of these guys that college was an option for them. And so I realized, to my mind, the answer is creating an ethos of college going, right? Everyone needs to think that college is an option if they're ever going to consider it. And when I say college, I use that term a little loosely. I don't mean simply four-year programs, but I mean most post-secondary programs, which is why, in the language of the bill, I've included career colleges, community colleges, and working on some amendment language to also get independent schools at the table. And if I knew what the answer was to creating this ethos of college going, I would have a different bill before you, but I don't know what the answer is at this point. So I've suggested we put together a task force of higher ed folks, high school folks, middle school teachers or elementary teachers, parents, students of underrepresented groups, and get all these voices at the table to sit around and say, how do we convince students that college is an option? And the State Board of Higher Ed and the written testimony that you have before you, I've taken some of their background information out of a report that Dalton will talk about later on college participation and completion. And it addresses various issues such as families need to be involved in this conversation. We can't only be talking to students about going to college, but we have to be talking to their families. Which reminds me, at this early conversation, someone mentioned, I believe maybe it was you, Senator Cruz, the college or education in general needs to be seen not as a private good, but as a public good. And I think that is part of what this bill gets at. If everyone is looking at some sort of post-secondary education, something beyond a high school diploma, you know, if that's the environment that we're growing up in, that's the atmosphere and the mindset that we're going to adopt when we're looking at our options after high school. So essentially, I've charged this task force with looking at how do we adopt the best practices of some programs that are already in place to start talking to students about college going early on, which currently serve less than half of Oregon's high schools. Programs like Aspire, which is state-funded, which works with students in the high school years with the application process. It talks to parents about applying for financial aid, et cetera. There's a Gear Up program. The OUS has received a federal grant. They've completed their first cohort. It starts with students in the seventh grade, partnering with middle schools, working with their high schools then, and following those students through their high school career, talking about college, helping with the application process, getting them on college campuses, assisting with visitations. They've currently received a grant for a second cohort of 12 partner schools, and all of those are schools in rural areas. So the task force essentially is looking at how do we get students statewide thinking of college, though it does specify certain underrepresented groups that I think we need to give, not necessarily a precedent, but prioritize and understand that these groups need these services most because right now they're the ones who aren't going. You have the list of those on here. They include low-income, first-generation college students, minorities, students with disabilities, and students from rural areas. And to go through very broadly, as I said, I've included a wide base of voices. I want everyone at the table, the OUS, or Oregon State Board of Higher Ed, you'll hear from Dalton Hess, their report, but I feel like reports from single boards often that results in sort of a top-down view of policy suggestions. I feel like this should not be a piecemeal policy suggestion, but rather we should have a comprehensive group of everyone who's invested so that there's a wider buy-in for creating this ethos of college going. And so I feel that creating this task force to address these various issues is the first step in the right direction. I'm not here to suggest legislation, but to say we need to have a wider discussion about what standards should be in place, and then maybe in a future session we can be here to say that these are the standards we want our students to have for considering college, whether that be time on a college campus, you know, filling out a college application in a classroom, attending an informational session on applying for financial aid or what have you. So I'm happy to answer any questions you have. I haven't addressed much of the bill specifically, mostly my reason for it. I think the bill on its own kind of speaks for itself. I will say there are some amendments in the works to address specific language changes that need to occur, such as the correct person appointing folks from various boards, and as I mentioned, including the independent colleges at the table as well.
Well, I appreciate you bringing it forward, and I agree that people need to look at the success when someone in rural Oregon goes to college or has the opportunity. That is not just a success for that individual, but it's a success for the rest of us. And I very much appreciate you incorporating this into that bill. And I think you were a nugget of inspiration there, too, it sounds like. Any questions, Stacy? Thank you. We do have some people signed up to testify.
I just point out it's not a rare thing for people from rural communities.
Okay, thank you, Stacy. Gary Ann
Dean.
Gary Ann Dean and Joe Holliday.
Thank you, Chair Hass. For the record, I'm Gary Ann Dean, the president of the Oregon Independent College Association. You can imagine that my principal reason for being here is to ask that the private colleges also have a seat at the table in this task force should you decide to move forward. Let me make a couple other comments first, however. I want to thank Stacy's parents for putting this idea of going to college in her head at a very early age. I want to thank Stacy for having carried it forward and having the social graces to think about all the other students in the state who haven't had that opportunity. I think this is just really a nice gesture on her part. I've only have one piece of paper for you today, which is unusual, but as you might guess, it's a bunch of numbers again. It does give you a little sense of how well we're doing in the community colleges and the state system and in the private colleges in Oregon at moving into some of those at-risk populations, specifically ethnic minorities. None of us are doing as much as we would like. There's certainly a great deal of effort going on all over the state to try to figure out better ways to get students prepared for and into and successfully through college. This would be one of many other groups that we're all participating in. If this task force does, however, coalesce some ideas that can come back to the legislature, that would be a good thing. That's my testimony. Thank you.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Holliday. I serve as an assistant vice chancellor in the Oregon University system. We are here to support Senate Bill 906 today. As Stacy mentioned, we would request a few days to work with her on amendments concerning committee composition and perhaps some critical areas of focus that my colleague Dr. Dalton Miller-Jones might suggest in a few moments. We are in the Oregon University system particularly concerned about ethnic and racial disparities in college participation and graduation, specifically a growing Latino Hispanic population, which has the lowest participation rates in college in Oregon. We're also concerned about African-American and American Indian participation rates, which are far lower than that of their white counterparts. We also have concerns about first-generation students, rural students, and what we are coming to call the lost generation of students, which is a group of adult learners who did not go to college in the aftermath of Measure 5. At this point, if your pleasure, I would like to introduce my colleague, Dr. Dalton Miller-Jones, who is a member of the Oregon State Board of Higher Education and a professor of psychology at Portland State University.
Welcome, Dr. Jones.
Thank you, Chair Haas and committee members. For the record, I am Dalton Miller-Jones, director of Oregon Board of Higher Education, a member of the Unified Educational Enterprise of the Joint Boards. I'm a professor of psychology and chair of the Black Studies Department at Portland State. I don't get a lot of sleep. The Oregon Board of Higher Education's Committee on Participation and Completion supports the creation of a task force to investigate ways of increasing the post-secondary enrollment of Oregonians from first-generation Latino, Hispanic, Native American, African American, and from low-income and rural communities, and for improving their retention to graduation once they are enrolled. We also support Senate Bill 906 and the call for a report that would contain specific recommendations and proposals for ensuring the attainment of goals for increased access and success of students from these communities. If the work of our committee is correct, the task force will find the following areas are critical for the successful inclusion of these students. A, financial aid sufficient to cover tuition and other expenses associated with attending college. B, improvements in the academic preparation in core areas of reading, writing, mathematics, and the sciences. C, a more inclusive and culturally responsive campus climate and instructional practices. There are other areas that were mentioned earlier by this bill sponsor around family and family support, and we would extend that to community and community support. While the Oregon Board of Higher Education and the Oregon University System, in collaboration with the Oregon State Board of Education and the Joint Board's Unified Educational Enterprise and the Office of Community College and Workforce Development, we have all been meeting over the last 2 years trying to get testimony and input from these various communities about the barriers to their participation. You have a record of that report. We also produced a series of policy option packages to be forwarded to the governor, which were not included in the governor's recommended budget to the legislature. Nevertheless, we are moving forward with an agenda that we think we can achieve some of our goals without the addition of money, additional monies. And this bill that is before you will allow us to, I think, attain a level of accountability in the whole system. I think it's an important addition to the work that we have been doing to rectify a situation that I would consider a disaster, frankly. Not only are we failing the various communities I just mentioned, I think we're just failing the average Oregonian at this point. We only have, as of the 2005-2006 data that I have before me right now, about a 22% participation rate of high school graduates into post-secondary education. We can't afford this. This is way too expensive a proposition for us. I'll give you just a few examples of what it costs us to continue to not act. It costs us, according to a report by the College Board itself, called Education Pays, an estimate that taking a cohort of about 1,000 women without a high school diploma that would cost this state, in social services an average of $1,750 per year, each year. For a total of about $1.75 million annually. those same 1,000 Oregonians with a bachelor degree would contribute $62 million in state and local taxes paid over their working lifetime. There are other statistics like this that I don't think we have time to go over, but you know as well as I do that we're talking about a disastrous situation, and we have to act. So this bill allows us to have a task force and a report that will gather the best information we have available and make recommendations for moving forward with this agenda. So I thank you for the opportunity to make a comment to you and to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, all of you, for being here and for your commitment. I hope that we can pass this, and I really look forward to seeing the recommendations, and I also hope that also retention rates can be considered. I'm not sure that I see that in the bill, but if we work hard to get students into college and they just don't stay there, we need to address that as well. So I see it as part of the same quest. You know, we might have some of the same issues, whether it be financial or societal or what, but I hope we can consider that as well when we're looking at the initial question. So thank you.
Thank you. And I just want to comment that we don't necessarily need to have this in statute, that a similar commission can still be organized and set through the Chancellor's Office or through the system to make a lot of this go. So thank you. I have Morgan Allen from the Department of Education signed up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and well, I guess fortunately for the committee, unfortunately for me, this is the first time I have to come in and kind of be the agency guy to the Senate Education Committee this biennium. I've already had to do this several times at the House Education Committee and many other committees in the on the House side, and I've, you know, talked to Stacey about this bill, and we've had some good dialogue, and I've hopefully given her some suggestions that can help with this. But the creation of another task force in the upcoming biennium is additional work that is going to be very difficult for the department to absorb. This bill has a very minor fiscal impact, you know, probably in the $20,000, $30,000 range, you know, for expenses and staffing the task force and putting the reports together and holding the meetings. There are at least probably five or six task force bills that I can think making their way through the process. Some of them are funded, some of them aren't. The cumulative impact of all those task force bills passing without funding is probably, you know, roughly the equivalent of a full-time employee at the department in the next biennium to do the work necessary on those task forces. And under normal circumstances and in a normal biennium, this is probably work that we could figure out how to absorb and figure out how to make this happen. It's a good piece of public policy. This is a good bill. It's something that we probably should have, you know, been doing of our own accord in K-12 and higher education already. But we've also entered a time where, you know, probably the best case scenario for agency, we're looking at a 15% reduction to staffing and funding for the department. That's probably a best case scenario. We're bracing ourselves for more. We've submitted cut lists up to 30% to our agency. We're going to have difficulty carrying out our core mission and our core functions and our statutorily mandated functions in the next biennium. I mean, the State Board of Education is looking at delaying portions of the new high school diploma. Schools are closing early around Oregon, so I know I'm kind of playing my little tiny violin, Mr. Chair, so thank you for indulging me. But I guess what I would say, and what I'm sort of obligated to put on the record, and what many of my agency colleagues do in this similar situation, is obviously it's the legislature's priority to move this piece of legislation forward and tell us to do it, and you're not obligated to provide funding to us. But what I would ask the committee, if that the committee thinks this is a good piece of public policy, that an appropriation be added to the bill so that we can pay for the task force. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, and I think we do understand. We push a lot of things your way at this level. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 906. And very quickly, committee, I want to open up a work session on Senate Bill 901. purposes of going through this legislative council opinion that you should have handed out to you today. And this was sought by Senator Bonamici. Senator, would you like to help walk us through the ramifications here?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may recall that the Senate bill that created the Oregon Employee Benefit Board, Senate Bill 426 from 2007, had some language that dealt with comparability, that a district didn't need to go into the benefit pool and unless they would receive comparable benefits, wouldn't have to pay more and get less. And when I went to look at that language in the codified statutes to respond to some questions that some of the districts have been having who either are not in yet because they are not at the point in their collective bargaining agreement where they needed to go in, or because they'd been given waivers because they couldn't get comparable benefits, lo and behold, I couldn't find the language in the statute. I found it in a footnote. And when I talked with legislative counsel, they explained that that was because the way that the bill had been drafted, it was put in a section that that actually was set to expire in September of 2008. And so my intent with the original bill was to add that comparability language back in and to do a couple of other things dealing with who did the comparability analysis. I had a couple of amendments drafted, but I was planning to have one ready for the committee today, colleagues, but as sometimes happens, the amendment that came back had a little drafting problem that I thought would have created an additional unanswered question and perhaps unintended consequence. So it is being redrafted. It does add the comparability language back into the statute. It clarifies that once a district is in, they can't jump in and out, and also allows the district or the collective bargaining unit to request a comparability analysis either every year or every 2 years. What I have for you today is an opinion from legislative counsel. I had asked the question of, does this language need to be put back into the statute because OEB does have a rule on how they determine comparability. And the opinion that came from legislative counsel, I think, is pretty clear that they said that we believe that Senate Bill 901 is, quote, absolutely necessary, close quote, to legislatively clarify the scope and applicability of Section 17, Chapter 7, Oregon Laws 2007, which was the comparability section. So when the amendment comes back, which I hope is soon and hope is correct, it will add that language back into the statute so that it's clear that a district that is not in OEB yet because of the timing of their collective bargaining agreement or because they have been given a waiver is clear that in the statute that they don't need to go into OEB if OEB cannot provide a comparable benefits at a comparable price. So my apologies for not having that ready today, but I didn't want to have something that would create an additional issue. I'll bring that back when it's done, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have, committee.
Questions? Thank you for your dogged pursuit of the truth, Senator Bonamici.
You're welcome,
and,
Mr. Chair.
Very much appreciate you for docking this for us, and we'll take this up again when we get amendments and or appropriate fiscal reports. So I will close the work session on Senate Bill 901, and I'll seek unanimous consent to allow Senator Cruz to vote on Senate Bill 484. Any objections? Seeing none. Senator Cruz, how do you vote on Senate Bill 484?
I think I'll vote aye.
Cruz reluctantly votes aye.
Well, no, just thoughtfully.
Thoughtfully. Okay. There is no other business. We are adjourned.